Hello and welcome to Dateline New Haven. I'm your host, Paul Bass, inviting you to look behind the headlines on the stories that make New Haven tick. Well, Nick Belletto started out making New Haven tick. Now he works to make all of Connecticut tick as the chairman of the Connecticut Democratic Party. The Democrats are at a crossroads in Connecticut and nationally. Nick is here in the WNHH studio to talk about this. Mayor Tony Harp is off today. She plans to be back here next week for her regular Mayor Monday program. You can join the conversation by posting a question on our Facebook Live page. That's the New Haven Independent Facebook Live page. Or you can call us here at 203-872-7ELM. 203-872-7356. And if we're not being forgetful, we will notice the call and take it. Today's program is made possible in part thanks to support from Bertram Moses and Devlin PC from Gateway Community College in downtown New Haven. Thanks, Gateway. Thanks, Bertram. And thanks, Nick Belletto. So nice to have you in the studio.
Great to see you, Paul. Thank you.
And I'm, as I asked you to get real close to that mic, you're doing a good job. And, you know, Nick, I always wonder about party chairs because, you know, you never really see them. You get fundraising appeals from them. They're quoted occasionally in the paper if there's some kind of controversy about party fundraising. But generally, you guys really work behind the scenes. Is your main job cultivating candidates at all levels and raising money? Is that basically the job of a state party chair?
Raising money, believe it or not, is a large portion of the job.
Well, I do believe that, yeah.
Yeah, it takes up quite a bit of the time to keep the party functioning, keep a staff going. But what I love to do and what I've tried to do as chair is to get out there in the field and to meet the town committees and be out there with the elected officials and try to be out there supporting as many possible candidates as we can. And one of the things we've really developed at the State Central Committee is a real training program for people who want to run and to teach them how to adequately run for office.
So you're looking for talent. There's been a lot of talk about nationally that Democrats feel they have to recruit candidates in purple states and just have a strong bench with all these baby boomers still dominating the top positions. So you're going out looking for people and you actually have a training program. What's that like? Like, where do they go for how long?
We've moved the training program all over the state, actually, but then most times it's at our headquarters up in Hartford. And what we do is we bring them in for a half a day or a day-long program where we teach people everything on how to run our van program, which is our great system on how to track voters and keep track of what you're doing out there.
What does VAN mean? Is that an acronym?
I actually don't know. It's a voter file. It's our voter file. It's a short term for our voter file. And what it does is keeps all the information on voters throughout Connecticut, but it keeps contact.
I'm the ignorant guy on the outside here. So does that mean the information you get, raw data, when you go door to door, your ones and twos, the people most likely to vote for you, and then you create your database, or do you buy these voter lists that are already prepared with voter preferences, or is it a combination that you crunch together?
It's actually a national voter file. So we buy it, and it's a whole national system, and we have Connecticut, and we actually own it as the state party. It's maintained by the Democratic National Committee, or an arm of the Democratic National Committee maintains it. But it's all our information that we've, and historical information that we've been able to keep on people who voted in primaries and when they voted and how often.
And does it
what
include independent voters, or is it just Democratic?
No, and we have all voters.
So do you get a sense of which independent? I mean, you don't know who voted for whom unless they tell you, right? Unless
Correct.
You look at results, you see a
right.
town that has a lot of independent voters that went heavily for Democrat. Maybe you get a guess that that's a Democratic-leaning independent base. But how do you drill down and know which independent voters to target? Is it just you have to go door-to-door and ask them?
Yes, or we have there's actually a scoring method where they're able to score people depending on when you voted and how you voted and what cycles you voted in. So if you voted in primaries or you voted in elections that went heavily Democratic, we're able to tell, you know, what their trend is and where they are.
So in other words, you can kind of guess that an individual in Fairfield, let's say, who's independent, once voted in the past Democratic primary or voted when a lot of Democrats independents voted for Jim Hines. So you're going to guess that person's independent, or you're going to guess enough that you're going to go ask them?
Oh, we're going to ask them. You basically make a field of who you're going to go ask and talk to.
You don't want to be driving some of the polls on election day who's not voting for you.
Correct.
Right?
But you're going to go talk to them ahead of time. All these voters we talk to ahead of time. Our whole system is reaching out and going door to door and reaching out to each individual voters. But what we try to do is to limit the people that you're going to talk to so you get out to the people who actually are going to come vote or who are interested, basically. And those that are interested are going to come out and vote, so you're not wasting your time as a candidate.
Any good examples of someone you've brought up? Now, how long have you been the state chair?
I'm going on my third year.
Going on, it means it's been 2 years?
I finished a two-year term. I started another one in February. Uh-huh. And I was vice chair for 4 years of the party.
So can you give me an example of someone whom you found through this training program and is now an elected official?
We have multiple state reps have come through the program, especially a couple of the ones that just got elected in the last cycle. I don't believe any of the senators yet have come through, but I think some people want to run this year.
So give me an example of one person. Tell me a story about this person who might not have been a candidate. You guys recruited her or him and made him an elected official.
We recruited one that actually a lot of them are at the local level. It's amazing in how many are running for commissioners, are on commissions, are on boards, are on city councils. We have a couple in Norwalk, which is great, where they started. They've come through the program. They've gotten trained and then decided to run for office. This year, I think you're seeing a huge influx. We've run through a lot of people who have come through the program or running for city council seats or other down ballot tickets this year.
Ballpark number?
I bet you this year we've probably run about 250 to 300 people through the program so far that are seriously interested in running.
And how many was it in past years?
Hardly any. I mean, we haven't had a training program like this up. We've had it for the last year and a half. So before that, there really wasn't a training program.
And is this partly
cycle.
A function of the reaction to the Donald Trump election? I mean, a lot of Democrats said, and independents, they were very upset about the election. And they said, and this is sort of what happened when Obama got elected for the Republicans. They said, we have to start running for local offices if we want to have the kind of country we want to live in. Is that too much to say that that's why you got 250 to 300 people come to a program to run for local offices?
Absolutely, 100% the reason. People have gotten to the point where they now have to, they realize you can't sit back. I mean, think about it, Paul. When you and I started 30 years ago, we were a lot younger. We were able to do things. It was a lot easier to live life. It was a lot less expensive. It was a lot easier to carry your life. Today, young families that start out basically can't afford homes. Can't find a place to live when you graduate from college, can't pay student loans because they're so ridiculous. So they don't have the time or haven't had the time to run for office or get involved. And I think the one thing that this cycle did after this last election in November was people realized that we can't just sit back. We have to find the extra time. We have to get involved and we have to actually do something to make a difference. And I think that's what you're seeing people come out and really want to make a difference.
And you're hearing about that on Dateline New Haven at WNHH Radio, your home for community radio at 103.5 FM, live streamed at newhavenindependent.org. We're talking to Nick Belletto, chairman of the State Democratic Party. Nick, so you started out doing that. You were only in your 20s when you won election to the what was then called the New Haven Board of Aldermen.
Correct.
In the Morris Covenant. What were you, like 24?
I think I was 21. I think 23. You're right, Paul.
23, and you were an accountant, right?
Yes.
And what made you run for office at such a young age?
I had started when I was about 16 working on one of DeLito's first...
Ben DeLito, former mayor's
campaign. And I just loved it. And I got involved and I worked with Vinnie Morrill Sr.
Chairman. His son is now the state... city chairman.
Yeah, and now his son's my dear friend and city chairman. And that's how I got involved, and I just stayed involved, and I just loved it. I loved the cycle, and
what
I loved to make
like
a difference.
What did you like about it at 16 years old? Do you remember knocking on people's doors? Were you going to grown-ups and saying... Hey, Mr. So-and-so, I want you to vote for Ben DeLito, and here's why? Or you just said, here's how you do it. If you want to do it, I'll bring you down.
One of my greatest experiences was, it was a huge difference for me, and I was on Elm Street and Lower Elm Street, which was much different then, and Chapel and Howe Street, registering voters with Brian McGrath, the old Brian McGrath, and who's still around New Haven, and he taught me how to register voters and how to get people to the polls and how to pull them on election day, and I just loved the excitement and to know that you could actually make a difference. And that's really what made me get involved. I love the city as you do, as well as I do. My heart and soul is in New Haven and always will be. It's just such a great city.
I remember you were a very good Alder, even though you were so young. I mean, we had a weekly paper then, The Independent. You were in it all the time, taking a real lead, both on constituent issues. You knew how to talk about what people care in your neighborhood, about their trash pickup and stuff. I remember trash pickup specifically. But you also threw yourself into city issues like education funding. But you didn't follow career in elected office. You didn't say, I want to keep running for higher and higher office. Instead, you did stay involved in politics, but behind the scenes, correct?
Yeah, I did not like the elected official portion as much as I thought.
Too many late night calls?
No, it wasn't. I love the people. I love people, and that's why I decided to stay in the second portion of it. I think I had, watching the sausage get made and sitting there and trying to get things passed and not being able to make a real difference, I didn't like it as... The slow movement of government is what drove me crazy. So I think I like the election
really
side
no
of it more.
There's alternative to that with democracy, you know?
Yes.
The boring, slow. It's frustrating for me. I could never be in government and follow civil service rules and take forever to do stuff.
Right.
And all the approvals over months to just like hire somebody. But I don't know if there's an alternative to that, if you're going to have a democracy.
Right. No, and I agree. The election cycle,
it's
I like
for everybody.
Because it's always going to change. You know, there's a different picture all the time. And I think that's what I like about the excitement of the election
cycle. You like elections.
Yeah, because it's just, there's always going to be a different picture. There's always a cycle. You're going to plan 2 to 4 years out and that's it. But even during that 2 to 4 years, the shade's going to change 3 or 4 times. And that's what I like about this.
Were you into sports?
System.
A lot of politics people like sports. And politics is sort of like a big game that you get psyched with the whole team and you try to win.
No, if my family's listening right now, they're probably hysterical because I'm the least athletic person you'll ever meet in your life. But I am a Red Sox. I'm a Red Sox fan from New Haven, so Italian American, which you'll never find. I'm probably one of the very few
really,
that you'll find around here. Yeah, this is a Yankee territory. They get very offended.
I thought it was on the cusp.
No, when you get to Middletown, it's more on the cusp, and it's there's not too many Italians, Americans.
Is that because it's easier to drive to New York than Boston?
No, I think it's because when we were kids, that's all the stations you had on TV. You really had the Mets and you had the Yankees, and that's really what you heard. And that's who the heroes were back when, my dad and grandparents were younger. They had Joe DiMaggio and, Yogi Berra and the people from, and then right next door to New York. So those were their great heroes of the day.
So you decided to go on the back, and you had some mentors. You worked with Arthur Barberi,
Absolutely.
Who's the legendary New Haven Democratic Town Chairman, the Mustache, as he was known. What did you learn from him that's been useful to you for this day?
It's very, very funny. I'm starting to repeat some of the stories and sayings that Arthur taught me years ago, and I call Vinnie Moore, I call Arthur's daughter, and I said, I just quoted your dad. I can't believe it. Shoot me. But, Arthur was chairman until he was 80.
Which was
amazing.
A long period in between when he wasn't. Yeah,
right. He went, but we brought him back in, I think, 89, and he was there for 8 years. And he was a good guy, and he taught me to believe in people, to help people, to believe in the community, and to make a difference.
What were one of his sayings?
If you sit on the porch long enough, everybody comes around again. Especially
in
New Haven,
that's a good
point. It really is. Absolutely,
that's a good point. One day he's your enemy, one day he's your friend.
Absolutely.
The other thing that was amazing about Arthur is how much attention he paid to the smallest decisions, like who's going to be on what ward committee. We have 30 ward committees, and their main job in most wards, although they're trying to do more with it in some places, is just to nominate candidates every year or two. And yet, Arthur paid a lot of attention to who was on what ward committee, who was named to what commission. And it seemed like, and then when there was a big matter up, like when he negotiated whether our delegation voted for George McGovern, which very few people know back in the Democratic Party in 1972, Eugene McCarthy in 68, he would negotiate with people from a position of strength from having mastered the process.
Absolutely. There's some great stories. Obviously, I was only 2 back then, but a lot of people tell us the great stories about when he walked into the Melbus Club and cut a deal with the
McCarthy
people. And
that's where everything happened. Melbus Club doesn't live anymore. Doesn't exist anymore. It was this mostly sunken, looked like a fortress. Was it a bomb shelter?
We laugh. We call it a bomb shelter.
Olive
I'm assuming it was.
Water.
Actually, I think there was a fallout shelter sign on it, so you might be right.
And it was Olive and Water Streets, and all the political events took place there.
Yes, and so Arthur walked in there with all the Yale students and basically cut a deal with them because he knew that was the right thing to do. And he was a political survivor. I mean, he survived until, if I'm not mistaken, I think it was 54 to 75 the first time.
Right, he was knocked out by the Frank Loeb Reform Democrats.
Correct. And then he came back in 89.
Okay, well, it sounds like we have a call from Bob. Bob, you're on WNHH's Dateline New Haven with Nick Belletto.
How you doing, Paul?
Good. How you doing, buddy?
It's not the mayor today, but Nick will do. How you doing, Nick?
Hi, how are you? Good morning.
Okay, good morning. I have a few questions for you. My first question I've been hearing a lot in the news lately is about Connecticut being a red state. When I hear of red, I'm thinking of Republicans. Is that a true statement?
No, absolutely not. The Democratic Party has all the seats in Congress, and we have the 2 senators, and we have the governor, lieutenant governor, all the constitutional officers. The House of Representatives is Democratic, and there's a tie in the House, in the Senate. And Hartford.
Although you can break the tie with the Democratic lieutenant governor.
Correct. Thank you, Paul.
Well, Bob, are you referring to the fact that the Republicans have made great gains in the last couple
that's
years?
Basically
so
what I,
the
well,
Democrats
that's
used to have a super majority in the House and Senate. And in fact, the Democrats won the governor's office 2 governor's races ago after not having had it from 1990 through 2010. But now, as Nick points out, the Democrats have all the offices. But there's this sense that the Republicans are greatly gaining. that that you know that they could take control of the House next time they're with it. Was it within 8 seats, Nick? And they are now tied in the Senate, and that people, even if people are upset about problems that have their genesis in Washington, they tend to blame the governor, wouldn't you agree, Nick, if taxes are too high for them or if the state's in financial problem, even if those problems go back 20, 30 years. Is that sort of what you're getting at, Bob?
Yeah, that's basically what I'm getting at. But lately I'm hearing on the news and reading is that Connecticut is now a red state.
Well, it's not when you look at voter registration, right? So the biggest group of voters, and tell me if I'm wrong, Nick Belletto, is independents, actually. Unaffiliated voters, I believe 700,000 or 800,000, if I'm right. Then the second biggest group of registered voters is Democrats, and is that around in the 500,000s usually? And then Republicans are another $100,000 voters less. Are we in the ballpark here?
I think that's about right.
So I'm thinking, Bob, what you're talking about is the trend, which is that the Republicans sense, they're like sharks sensing blood in the water. It's been 6 years in the Malloy administration. He did raise taxes with the hope of having a balanced budget, but it didn't happen. We have a $5.1 billion deficit we have to make up for the next 2 years. So this kind of sense like the incumbents are going to pay. I mean, how do you think about that, Nick?
I think one of the things you have to look at, and back to the basic question, is that the numbers that we had in November, if you look at some of our special elections that have taken place, we've had 5, I believe, now since the November election. And one seat alone was a Senate seat where we lost, but was the most Republican Senate seat, second most Republican in the Northeast, and the most Republican in Connecticut. And we actually lost it by about 18,000 votes in November, and we were under 2,000 votes in the special election in February.
And it's sort of like the Ossoff election in Georgia. People are kind of looking at that as a bellwether of whether Democrats are going to make gains from people being upset with Donald Trump.
Correct. So I don't think you're going to see us certainly not go backwards. I think we're going to pick up some steam. I think you see the activists and people wanting to be involved in the party, and people are just finding a place to go. So my job is to make sure that everybody finds a place to go by this November and certainly by next year's election so we can get people focused on the Democratic electoral.
You're right, Bob?
Yeah, I'm okay. I had one more question, Paul.
Okay, hit it.
And it concerns the governor's race as far as the Democrats go. There have been a number of Democrats that have announced, including Mayor Ganim of Bridgeport.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about
others.
That. That's amazing. I'm sorry, go on.
Do you foresee Lieutenant Governor Wyman or State Senator Kennedy entering the race, Nick?
I think you'll see each one of them make a decision shortly. I think it would be fair to the entire rest of the people in the race for them to make a decision very soon so people can qualify. I think the hardest part of the job of running for governor is to qualify for the public financing for the campaign. It's going to take some time. And that's where we're really going to see who's actually in the race as governor, who's going to drop out to another.
So you're using that as a bellwether now. It's interesting. So public financing, where you have to get a certain number of minimum contributions from registered Democrats in the state to qualify for public matching dollars. You're now, I guess, using that as a bellwether to see whether someone has popular support?
Yeah, I think that is the major bellwether now, unfortunately. And
unless you get someone who's self-financed.
Right. And I know, hopefully, you know, we don't like Democrats to self-finance. There's a public system that everybody's in favor of, and that's why we supported it right along. And one of the things
Dan
like
Drew's working that one really hard.
Correct. And that would be one of the bellwethers, because it took the governor, I think, almost 14, if I'm not mistaken, and I might be the first time, I think it took 14 months.
Wow.
To qualify. So it takes a long time to get to that level, those small donations.
I wonder whether that level needs to be changed so that more people have a chance to run. You don't make it too low because you don't want to have a free-for-all where you're spending a lot of public dollars and people have no chance.
Right.
But you don't want it so high that only people who already have institutional backing can run.
Correct.
All right, so Bob, thank you for your question.
I got one last question.
Okay, hit us one more, Bob.
And I'll make it real quick. Do you think that people in Connecticut vote for name recognition?
No, I clearly...
You understand what I mean?
Yeah, I do. And no, I don't believe that. I think people clearly... Connecticut has sophisticated voters. I think that's very clear. And you've seen upsets here in Connecticut. And I think people clearly vote for people they believe in. And especially Democrats, you see the primary where there was a Lieberman against Lamont. Ned Lamont was, nobody even knew who he was, and Lieberman's name recognition was through the roof, and people felt that, in the at least in the primary factor, that they decided to support Ned Lamont. And I think that's it. I think Connecticut has very sophisticated voters, and they watch who delivers for them here in Connecticut. And I think they pay attention to that.
All right, Bob. And thanks so much for the call, Bob. You're listening to WNHH Radio's Dateline New Haven. Our guest today is State Democratic Chairman Nick Bileto, at the center of a lot of the discussions going on today about the future of the Democratic Party. Few people, I'm sorry, folks, the Facebook Live feed has at times punked out. My station manager, Harry Gross, the bravest man in New Haven, tells me we can't control that. But we can't control the messages we got, right, Harry? Some people have been writing in, we'd like to read what they had to say. Can I get this back? Okay, I guess we're going to have to hold off on that whole thing. I was waiting for a moment to say those. Okay. Okay. So, Nick, we got it. I've mentioned the $5.1 billion budget deficit in Hartford. This obviously has to be worrying you, someone who has to shepherd the party, because your party's still in charge, although it's not able to rule as seamlessly as it did before when it had a stronger majority. Where do you see as the way out in a special session? Do you think the legislature is going to be able to come to terms for an agreement on the budget, a Democratic plan, or do you think revenues are going to need to be raised? What would you like to see happen?
I like to see a compromise. Again, the governor does not want to see revenues or taxes raised. And I think what you're going to see is a compromise of where, you know, the cutting's going to be. The unions have taken or agreed to major concessions, and I think that's a huge portion of the budget.
And they just announced the deal today.
Yes, okay. And the CBAC deal sometime this morning. And
that's going to make the coalition of state government unions.
Correct. And that'll be a huge difference in support of the budget from not only now, but it's also huge going forward. It's an enormous effort and a help to the budget as we go forward.
Republicans say it's not enough. It ties your hands over the long term of being able to get more concessions. And they say that there have to be just drastic reductions in spending. What's your response to that?
I think clearly there'll be reductions in spending. And I think the governor's proposal and budget had showed that. I think the Republicans have sent out an irresponsible budget on their own, and they tried to sell it as something that was balanced, but it basically slashed everybody, didn't grow jobs here in Connecticut, hurt the cities majorly, certainly didn't help economic growth. As you know, you and I talked about, we're both from New Haven, we started out here, what we saw 30 years ago as opposed to what we're looking at today, the development in downtown New Haven is just absolutely astonishing and amazing. And that's by help by not only Mayor Harp's administration, but certainly by help from the governor and the state of Connecticut, helping with funding and bringing projects and development here into the cities like New Haven and certainly Hartford and obviously Bridgeport and Stamford and other cities, but here in Connecticut. And that's how it flows, and that's how we grow, and that's how we're going to grow jobs. I mean, you just saw that Amazon's coming with 1,800 jobs right next door in North Haven, which is just absolutely amazing.
Well, you get hit a lot about how GE moved its headquarters. Aetna's moving its headquarters. So the Republicans are feeling that's going to be a good talking point against you guys next year when we have legislative and gubernatorial elections. What is going to be the response to you guys lost Aetna and GE?
I get really, really mad, especially when it comes to GE. Anybody who's ever done business in Connecticut or did any research or reads the beyond the second or the headline will realize that the GE deal was long in the works, had nothing to do with the state or the governor. They were already in works to sell their New York building, which is a major, major building in New York City, right smack in the middle of the city. And what they had developed in Boston, they were looking for the best deal.
They were also looking to be in a campus. So what I've heard the Democrats say is, first of all, those are a lot fewer jobs than the jobs we've added. These are headquarter jobs. That the company said by its own memos that it wasn't about tax policy. It was about being in an academic research environment hub where they can draw on that kind of environment rather than a sleepy suburban campus, and that's an argument for more public investment rather than less.
Absolutely. And what you saw was, if you look at the map of Boston and what they planned on and where they're moving to outside there, that the eminent domain and the whole project, that has been being put together for years. A massive amount of assumption of property like that wasn't something they were doing overnight. So they were in negotiations, and they admitted, if I'm not mistaken, that they've been in negotiations for this for over 6 years without telling anybody. And Aetna clearly is, you have a CEO who would like to prefer to live somewhere else, and that's why he decided to move that, and he's not very shy about saying that.
Now, you've been a veteran of campaigns now for 30 years.
Yes, sir.
I understand the merits of what you're saying. How do you make that argument in an email or a campaign ad when you're getting clobbered by the Republicans? You lost Aetna, you lost GE.
I think you have to show what jobs are going to remain here. I think you're going to see some high expensive executive jobs are leaving, may leave Aetna, but the regular basic jobs are going to stay here in Connecticut, and the campus is going to stay here. Overall campus will stay here in Connecticut. And the same thing with GE. Basically, they shrunk the campus size, but they kept a tremendous amount of jobs here in Connecticut and will continue to do that. And I think that's what we have to show people, the dollars that actually may have moved, what types of jobs those were, and the actual day-to-day average people, middle class, and have stayed here in Connecticut.
Okay, we got some comments from listeners. Marcia Denenberg says, we know Hillary won the election, but it was stolen by illegal means and Russia. There must be a new election. Trump is fake president. He never should have been put in WH. Illegal, fake, humble, horrible person to be in the White House. Nick, you know what that makes me wonder? I'm looking at the way Democrats have been reacting to the Ossoff election, to the Russian investigations. Do you think Democrats are making a mistake by continuing to litigate the last election rather than trying to make a better pitch to voters for why they should be for them? Do you think that they might be overly focused on exaggerating some of the Russia allegations?
I think people should question it. I think people should look at it. I think there should be an investigation. I don't think it should be our sole focus. You know, we played by the rules. We lost by the rules, with the Electoral College and electoral numbers. Whether there was something that divided that up, that's what we have to really look at. And I think that's going to be the major factor going forward. But we have to be annoyed and angry and just completely twisted by the guy that's in the White House. I say to people, I was not a George Bush lover, but I respected him as president of the United States. This guy, I can't have any respect for. It's impossible to respect the gentleman in the White House. You cannot respect him as president of the United States. And I'm somebody who loves history. I mean, I just love history. I've loved and respected past presidents, whether they're Republican or Democrat. And you always respected them as the president, even if I thought they were crazy. And even when you went to war, I always thought you supported the president, whether you agree with it or not. You fight right up until the point you're going. But once we go and we put our men and women in harm's way, I think it's for us to support the president of the United States because he is the president of the United States. This guy, I just don't have the respect for.
But the question is, how do you rebuild? Now, the Democrats keep losing. They've lost these special elections. They did better, as you said, like in your state legislative election here and the Ossoff election in Georgia. He did much better than Democrat had done. But still, there have been these special elections in purple areas or slightly red areas where the Democrats have not capitalized on the anger over Trump.
People need to need to get focused on Paul. The one thing I will give Priebus and the Republicans and the Koch brothers, were somewhat ingenious and caught the Democratic Party nationally sleeping, is they were able to put people in local offices throughout the entire country and groom people for local offices in the entire country. And that's why they gained a tremendous amount of House and Senate seats throughout America. And that's why it's very dangerous. And that you hear a big fight about gerrymandering and where we're going to go in redistricting for Congress, because a large portion or a majority of the House and Senate throughout the country are controlled by the Republicans. And it's very dangerous. So we need to make sure that people realize here in Connecticut that the local races are important, because that's how we groom people to run. That's how we get a bench of people that want to get involved and get people involved in the local races, because that's where the difference is going to be made.
And that's what Nick Belletto is doing as Democratic state chairman in Connecticut here on WNHH Radio, Dateline New Haven. Thanks, other people, for comments, but we're going to move on from Hillary. I guess Linda Henderson. Hillary won the election. I think he should be booted out of office for fraud. He was in hack Russia. Why Senate doesn't impeach, prison him? Okay, so we're moving on from that. So what about the positive plan that the Democrats put forward? In the last election, presidential election, I heard two messages coming from Connecticut Democrats. And tell me if I'm wrong about this. In New Haven and from the state party on issues, I was hearing a Bernie Sanders message, single-payer health care, free college tuition, fight Wall Street. And the party voted for Hillary Clinton as sort of a more realistic chance, they thought, to win the election, or someone who had better support, really deeper support, especially in the black community. Am I reading that wrong?
I think somewhat. I think after coming out of the convention, I think we basically merged everything together and both parties and took the best of both campaigns.
Oh, sure. I remember before that, though, like in the primaries, I remember Martin Looney would give, before he gave his endorsement, he gave a Bernie Sanders speech. Like, you would not be able to tell who gave the speech when he talked about what issues he was considering. And they said, and therefore I'm supporting Hillary Clinton.
I think what you see is we're a large tent. We're a large tent party. We all don't agree for sure. We have major debates and major discussions, and we may all believe different things, but we come together on the basic issues that we do
and
believe in.
And that's the challenge that always faces a chairman. You're in the hot seat for that, the way the Republican chairmen are, which is, how do you keep your base, which will be much more liberal in primaries, and still keep in the Casey's from Pennsylvania, the people who are more moderate, don't go along with the orthodoxy on certain issues, let's say like abortion, but still make it their party too, so you have the greatest number of people. And in the last election, the way the argument played out was some people felt that that actually loses you the general election, that approach, that Hillary didn't inspire younger voters enough because she didn't take a tough enough stand on Wall Street. She kind of talked out of both sides of her mouth on trade or on single-payer health care or, you know, expanding Medicare. And that, does this kind of make us reexamine our thought about the way politics and elections work? They would be, and now Bernie Sanders isn't even a Democrat. People always leave that out. He's not a member of the Democratic Party. But this argument about whether you go, because the conventional wisdom is that the toughest job just about in politics are the Nick Bileto jobs, where you have to get the base excited, have someone win a primary in a fair process, but then pivot in the general election to get the center, especially in a place like Connecticut with so many independent voters. But the argument made from 2016 from some people, maybe right, maybe wrong, I'm not an expert, is that that's no longer the way the math works, that you have to excite the base and stand for something, even if people aren't going to totally agree with you. Like, a lot of Trump's voters didn't agree with everything he stood for. A lot of Sanders voters, in fact, some of them actually voted for Trump, that it's more that they're looking for sincerity and a coherent message.
I hate Monday morning quarterbacks, Paul, but I'm going to say the one thing you look at the presidential campaign going into November is there was no clear, direct message on what difference was going to be made if Hillary Clinton was going to be president. And I see that as the clear mistake that was made by the campaign. Instead of just continually saying Trump is a bad person, and as you brought up before, I don't think that could be our campaign either. I think we have to look at everything he's done and everything he's erased and how he's just turned this country upside down, and that everything Obama and basically bipartisan support to get this country off the ground again, he's basically erasing slowly. And I think that's clearly, if we didn't learn anything from that campaign, we learned that people want a clear message, want to know what we're going to do, what we're going to deliver, and we just can't say everybody's bad because it doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about age? Howard Dean was here in New Haven recently speaking at Yale. He said it's time for baby boomers to move out of the way. You had Trump and Clinton who are 70. You had Bernie Sanders is talking about running for president again. He's going to be 78 in the next campaign. You have Joe Biden talking about running. He'll be that kind of age. I know that people are being healthier longer, but do you think there's a problem of baby boomers not pushing aside for years? I mean, when we look at who are some of the likely candidates in this election coming up, Nancy Wyman, who's very popular, she's going to be 70. Do you think that baby boomers need to move aside?
Well, I think clearly, like we talked about Ted Kennedy, and you see there's much younger people in this race for governor. Dan Drew, Joe Ganim, as you said. I mean, everybody's either under 50, between 50 and 60 there.
Well, Drew's young.
Yeah, I think that's what I'm saying. He's below 40.
He's pitching
himself
as part of some group of national Democrats who are in their 40s, yeah.
So I think, you know, you're seeing a huge difference in our party. But I think it was the bench and people not being able to get involved. And I think now as you see us bringing more and more people up, hopefully that's going to change. And that's one of the purposes of doing the trainings and recruiting younger people to want to get involved and
get
start
the bench
at the
going.
Local. Right.
Which the Republicans did kind of a good job of that with the Tea Party, didn't they?
They did a great job. I hate to say it. That's the one thing they were very successful at was bringing up young people and running them on local.
Well, the Democrats did that in 74 after the Watergate scandal.
Yes.
Right? And then you started seeing a lot there was the class of 74, the Democrats came in, the Gary Harts in Connecticut, the Bill Currys, you know, who got involved in politics, but now they're the old guys. Yes. Sharon Gibson writes in, we need corporations out of politics. No more paying for candidate campaigns and no voting. If you can't die, you can't vote. Then elect a monopoly breaker and a Congress to get our country back in track. Thank you for your comments, Sharon Gibson. So I think what that question is getting at, Nick, is the role of money in politics? Now, you spoke earlier that you're a big fan of the campaign finance system, which lets smaller donors get involved. What about the challenge facing a chair? Like Nancy Pelosi, when she was questioned about whether she should continue to be the House Speaker, she said, all these people running for re-election, these congressmen, I'm the one who can get them the big donations, the big corporate donations. And again, the Sanders people shot back. Sanders succeeded by getting average of $28 donations and showed that you can compete with a strong message that fires up the grassroots and gets you a lot of small donations. Obviously, as a chairman, you're going to want to do both. Is there any sense that going for those corporate donations waters down your message, gives too many compromises so that you're not going to be distinguished enough from Republicans and not be able to raise that money?
Unfortunately, Paul, you have to do both right now under the current system. If the system was changed, which I would be thrilled, and corporate money was taken out of all campaigns across the board, then that would be fine. I would be fine with that.
Don't unilaterally disarm.
Right. If it was unilaterally done, then I think you'd be fine. Unfortunately, it's not unilaterally done, and there's a lot of dark money on the Republican side, certainly from the Koch brothers and other people, and Walmart and other people throughout the country, where they donate and they dump in large amounts of money that we can't necessarily fight off. The small donations are great, and they work in it. You know, we love them, and the people are wonderful, and it's always amazing to me that the people with the least amount of money usually try giving the most.
I know in my life who gave most of the presidential campaign were the people who were poor.
Right, absolutely.
And I see that. And excited to give the small donations.
And Paul, you would be shocked. I mean, I look at it and my heart just is like, I'm amazed at what people will contribute and give and just reach out or will do a reoccurring contribution to us at the party. And it's just wonderful. It's wonderful to see that. But that unfortunately doesn't sustain the party. And if across the board we got rid of the contributions of corporations, that would be great. Same thing like public. I mean, I believe everybody should do public financing. I don't think you should be able to self-fund. I've always been against
the Buckley-Vallejo decision in the Supreme Court, I believe it was 76,
yeah.
Said that you can't force someone to self-fund. And that kind of set the basis for saying that giving money is a form of free speech. So that we then got the Citizens United's decision saying that corporations are people and you can't stop their free speech rights to give them money.
Which just has caused chaos in campaigns. I mean, yeah. It just really has caused chaos on where the money comes from and what's done in campaigns. I would much prefer to see that everybody goes out and does public financing instead of self-funding. And this way, everybody's not even playing ground. If everybody's not even playing ground, then it's a fair game.
Speaking of self-financing, you worried about Morning Joe Scarborough running for... the Republicans as governor?
You know, he's always a blowhard and he threatens a lot and he just he'll say and do what he has to get through today's ratings. I'm hoping that he makes his decision and figures out what he's going to actually do and do something going forward, but he hasn't as of yet.
I want to ask you, Nick Belletto, Democratic chairman in Connecticut, the role of labor has been interesting in Connecticut because nationally labor has been very weakened. The anti-union forces have taken over state houses in formerly pro-union states like Wisconsin. The Koch brothers have funded anti-labor legislation in states across the country through a group called ALEC. But in Connecticut, we still have unions that matter. Will they matter so much is the question. So in New Haven, the Unite Here unions support and run the candidates who totally control the Democratic Town Committee and the Board of Alders. Statewide, it's a little trickier, right? It's a little more of an even match, but they form it's still an important part of the Democratic Party. What's going to be the future of labor's role in politics, given their declining numbers and given their losses, Supreme Court, state houses?
I mean, as long as I'm around, labor will certainly continue to be one of our partners at the party. They fill a huge void for us. They've been very supportive and always helpful. I could name some firefighters, UAW, just some great unions, teachers, obviously, carpenters, the building trades, been very, very, operating engineers. I should not name, I'm probably going to get myself in trouble, but there's some great unions out there. We're really hardworking middle-class people. My dad was a union guy his whole life, worked for the phone company.
Oh, yeah, so SNET, those were the jobs that everybody wanted in New Haven, and the Yale job in SNET, because they had unions. You got job security, you got a pension, you got a decent pay.
My dad now, he had to get two hips and knees and his hands are, it's a big difference when he worked outside for 35 years. So he needed that union to protect
him. Oh, was he a lineman?
Yeah. So it was a big difference, people protecting. Unions were different than, you needed a protection and things were much different when you went out and worked back in the 60s and the 70s as you, a little safer today than it had been back then. But So, yes, unions will always be part of our team and will be always part of our family, and hopefully we'll be able to protect them and continue to, you know, help them and support them as long as we go.
How about back home? Do you still live in East Shore? Or do you...
No, I moved to Guilford about 15 years ago after I actually left as chairman here in New Haven. I stayed on for about a year and a half, and then I decided to move away because I was going to stay in some of the fights and fray here in the city, so I decided to get out of the play politics from a distance.
Have you noticed that neighborhood change, Morris Cove? It was, I mean, it's still where Donald Trump got his biggest vote in New Haven, but he did not get the majority vote. It's still where Justin Ellicker got a vote sort of against Tony Harp. Have the dynamics of that neighborhood changed?
Yeah, much, absolutely. I think I was with Vinnie Morrow during one of the campaigns. It might have been Obama's first or second, where Obama actually won the 18th Ward, and I was shocked. I've been usually a pretty good barometer out there on what's going to take place and where it's going to go. And obviously that is our most Republican conservative district in the entire city. And it's changed quite a bit. My parents are still there. So I spend a lot of time out there in Morris Cove, and I still love it.
I noticed a lot of spillover from liberal younger people who can't afford East Rock anymore. There are gay couples buying houses
absolutely.
There. There are some African-Americans. And,
absolutely.
And I kind of feel like there are two Morris Coves, to tell you the truth. I feel like there's an older Morris Cove and a newer Morris Cove.
I got to tell you, Paul, I would have believed that years ago. But when you think about my dad, who grew up in the 60s, lived here through the riots in New Haven and the fires, and he voted for Barack Obama. My father's not a liberal Democrat by any stretch. You know, he's basically some of the voters that Trump attracted during the last election. And my father stayed with Obama and voted for him the first time and the second time and was there.
So what turned him against Hillary?
I actually didn't ask him how he voted for Hillary, to be honest
Sounds
with you.
Like you voted for
that
Trump.
Was the one now that I'm just thinking about it. I was thinking about Obama, but we never had the discussion on Hillary. So you see, I think the Cove has changed quite a bit. You know, Morris Cove has changed, and I think the city's changed quite a bit. And I think people are more integrated. He did have a neighbors who were a gay couple, and the kids are at the house all the time. So things have changed. You know, what you would have expected in the 60s and the 70s are much different than they are today.
I think people forget how much society has moved forward.
Absolutely.
Like it's moved back in some ways, but especially like on gay rights, it's moved forward
absolutely.
So fast.
It's like, yeah, there's no gay rights from when I was a kid to now. It's just absolutely amazing. You would have never seen families and couples and kids. And, you know, it was just so different growing up than what you see today. And it's a wonderful thing. It's just absolutely amazing.
I'll never forget of you in a campaign was on 9/11, was the mayoral primary in New Haven between John DeStefano and Martin Looney. And it was the first time since 1993 we had a truly competitive mayoral election. For months, it was leading up to all this excitement. There were people all over the state giving money to it, spending time in the election. And the morning the Twin Towers get hit and everything gets thrown apart. And I remember I didn't know the Twin Towers hit. I walked in to check in on you and the Democratic campaign and the DeStefano office on Orange Street. And you were standing at the TV with Rose in the mayor's office.
I can't believe you remember that. Yes.
And you were saying... And you said to me, have you been to Israel? That was the first thing you asked me. And I remember thinking how this did seem to have something to do with the Middle East. And you know, we were just watching. The second tower hadn't been hit yet. We stood there while the second tower hit. How did that affect the way you ran that campaign that day? And did it make you think, draw any conclusions about the unpredictability of campaigns?
You couldn't run a campaign at that point. And there was a question whether the governor was going to cancel the election or not.
And New York, they did for 2 weeks.
Right, in New York they had. But at our point was... We had already spent every penny we had in the campaign, so to cancel it wasn't going to do us any good or postpone it, so really we had to go through with it at that point.
What did Looney want? Who was it up to?
I think everybody had a discussion generally at the campaign because they were asking both sides, what they wanted at that point, and at that point we just had to run through it because canceling would not have helped us at that point, and if people were not going to vote. But what happened is all the people we registered to vote, nobody came out to vote. And that was the real hard fact in that campaign. All the new voters that we went out and tracked it and vote, everybody went home that night. Everybody was so devastated that voting was the last thing they were going to do. And being able to pull somebody out of their house and get people out to vote and the usual stuff that Democrats are so known for just completely fell apart that primary day. And I'll never forget it. My heart sank. And it's funny, I always talk about the story, is I didn't know what was going on and I heard all the noise. I don't remember if it was the radio or the TV. They were next to each other.
It was TV.
And I didn't know what was going on. And I turned it on. And I actually was watching the second tower, the second plane.
I was with you when
second plane
hit.
And I thought it was a remake of the first one. And I was so confused and dumbfounded. I didn't know what the heck was going on. And I don't think I'll ever forget that. And I'll definitely always remember where I was standing on 9/11. And it was just a devastating day.
So Martin Looney's take is he would have won if not for 9/11 because his older voters are the ones who were more likely to stay home. Now, I don't know if that's true or not. One thing I did know, I then ran around with his campaign manager, Jason Bartlett, and when he went to his offices, it was empty. No one was pulling for them. But when we went to, let's say, Martin Luther King School, which is now the Amistad School, the Stefano forces in the black community were out and working. So do you think your base was maybe still working and less affected by it, or what was the reason?
Yeah, I think we were losing our base. I mean, our base were a lot of volunteers, less paid.
No, but I saw people out.
For Looney?
No, for DeStefano.
Right, I think ours. I'm saying on that side, I was on the Looney side and that campaign.
Oh, you were on the Looney side?
Yeah, I was on the Looney side. That's why I ended up not being continuing to be chairman after that.
Oh.
So I ended up helping Marty Looney in that campaign. In doing so, you know, knowing it was how difficult it was going to be.
Huh.
You know, people just did not want to get pulled and
but
did not want to go.
But that brings me to today. Now, and obviously I'm not comparing 9/11 to an election that you lose, but there was something momentous about the Trump election that caught everybody by surprise about how you thought political models would work, how people like you who are political professionals can gauge elections. Everybody was way wrong, right? So the pollsters said it was a 99% or 100% chance that Hillary would win. And she lost pretty solidly in Electoral College. Has that changed? Did the 9/11 day or that election change the way you go about predicting elections, organizing campaigns, thinking about the way politics works?
I've always been a little crazy in my approach to election day, but it's, you got one day, it ends at 8 o'clock, you don't have any choices, you don't stop, you keep going. And that's the job of running an election, and somebody running an election has to do that. No matter what the circumstances are, no matter what happens, you have to do that. You know, there's hardly ever is there a change of date or change of time or a continued election unless something major happens, and you have to be ready to expect and deal with whatever takes place. So the Trump election, I think we're all just shocked because it was so bizarre that we never thought the American people would elect someone as, well, we thought out of the mainstream, as crazy as possibly could be, so unrelated to the American people, had never, you know, had to work for a real job in his life, did not know what the Rust Belt was going through, but he obviously delivered a much better message to them.
So you think it's about the message?
Yeah, absolutely.
So tell me what the message is going into next year for the Democrats in Connecticut.
The message next year has to be clearly that we feel, we understand, we see what everyone's going through here in Connecticut. The governor has done major, responsible things to turn the state around and to fund and have a responsible budget as we go ahead. And I think that's what Democrats do, that's what we fight for. And we try to make a better life for people here in Connecticut. And I think that's proven along on, you just see, you know, Connecticut had the best Affordable Care Act system in the entire country. Whether you agree with it or not, and whether you think Obamacare worked or didn't work, my thing has always been, since I was a kid, whether you're moderate, conservative or not, that people should have health care in America. Whether you're a child or a senior, you should not have to worry about where your pills are going to come from or whether you're going to have adequate health care service here in the United States.
All right. Well, you made this a better day on Dateline New Haven. Nick Belletto, thanks for coming on WNHH Radio today.
Tell us about
your work as chairman of the Democratic Party of the state of Connecticut. Thank you for joining us. Thank you to Bertram Moses and Devlin PC and Gateway Community College in downtown New Haven. Thanks for supporting today's program. We're going to take it out with the Afro-Semitic Experience performing I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free from the CD Plea for Peace. This is Paul Bass reminding us all that we do know what it feels like to be free. We just have to book our flight. Book your flight and fly free with us all day and all night long here. WNHH Radio, New Haven's home for community radio.